You know, the sheer amount of stuff coming out of the federal government every single day, it can feel like you're trying to drink from a fire hose, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
News alerts, policy shifts, court cases. It's a lot to track.
Yeah. And figuring out what it all means, that's the real challenge, which is exactly why you're here, tuning into The Deep Dive. We're the show that tries to cut through all that noise. We sift through everything, the articles, the reports, you name it, to pull out the really important insights.
Basically giving you a shortcut to being genuinely informed.
Exactly. We tailor these deep dives for you, the listener, so you get a clear, full picture of what's actually happening in Washington and why it matters.
With maybe a little bit of humor thrown in,
Yeah,
hopefully.
we try. Okay, let's unpack this. You're diving into the federal news update for Friday, August 15th, 2025. I'm Alex Johnson, and I'm really looking forward to guiding you through today's deep dive.
And I'm Sam Kennedy, here to help connect some of those dots and explore what these developments might mean down the road.
And our mission today, well, it's pretty ambitious. We're aiming for a thorough, comprehensive, really exhaustive report on basically every action and activity from the U.S. federal government starting August 14th, 2025.
And we're not just listing things off.
No way. We want to really dig in, discuss the immediate impact, the long-term implications, get into those granular details that shape everything. We're going to debate the nuances too.
We've pulled from a huge range of sources: presidential directives, court rulings, new laws, agency shifts, you name it.
Right. The goal is to distill it all down so you can really grasp what's going on and, crucially, why you should care.
And August 14th was definitely a packed day. As we look through everything, you really start to see a clear picture emerge, don't you?
You do.
It's like a snapshot of this administration's whole approach.
Yeah.
Projecting strength, pushing this big domestic agenda really aggressively.
Yeah, a lot of decisive action, delivering on campaign promises.
Right, but also some really fundamental reshaping of federal agencies. And a communication strategy that, let's say, sometimes seemed pretty disconnected from what independent analysts were saying.
That divergence is definitely something we need to explore. It really sets the stage for, well, some potential conflicts down the line.
It really does. It highlights some of the big shifts happening under the surface.
Okay, so that's a perfect setup. Let's start right at the top then with the president and the White House. Their communications always set the tone, signal what's important to them.
Exactly. So on August 14th, President Trump put out a presidential proclamation. And there was a pretty detailed statement with it, too, all about the 90th anniversary of the Social Security Act.
90 years. That's a big milestone. Seems ceremonial, maybe.
Well, on the surface, yeah. But strategically, it was doing something else. It was clearly being used to frame the administration's recent legislative wins, their policy priorities. By tying them directly to Social Security, this program that's, hugely popular, deeply trusted, it's a classic political maneuver. Associate your new stuff with something everyone already likes.
And they didn't just mention Social Security, did they? They specifically linked it to that big new law, the OBBBA.
Repeatedly, the historic One Big Beautiful Bill Act. They claimed it delivers, quote, "the largest tax break for seniors in the history of our country."
By making most Social Security benefits tax-exempt at the federal level.
That's the claim, making the vast majority of benefits tax-exempt.
Yeah.
The name itself, One Big Beautiful Bill, it's quite something.
It sets expectations, like you said, maybe a marching band is involved somewhere.
Ah, maybe. But yeah, as we'll get into, the reality, especially when you look at the independent analysis, it gets a bit more complicated than the shiny label suggests.
That's usually the case in DC.
It really is. And this is a perfect example of what you might call policy symbiosis. It's actually quite skillful politically. They take this OBBA bill, which has a lot of parts, some pretty controversial, and they essentially wrap it in the flag of Social Security.
Okay.
It's not just promotion, it's like political camouflage. Use the public's warm feelings for Social Security to shield the trickier parts of the OBBBA. Kind of head off criticism before it even starts. It's smart framing.
And the proclamation didn't just stop at the tax breaks, right? It talked about strengthening the program itself.
Oh, yeah. It went into detail about a multi-pronged strategy. Things like cracking down hard on fraud, waste, and abuse, stopping payments to people who've died, making sure only those legally qualified get benefits. Standard stuff, but emphasized.
Did they give any proof? Any
And
number?
they did. They threw out some specific metrics: a 26% reduction in the backlog for initial disability claims,
Yep.
a 23% drop in average wait times at field offices, and cutting 29 hours of scheduled weekly downtime for the online accounts.
Those sound like concrete improvements.
They do. And they're presented that way as proof the whole system is getting better. But you know, the question you have to ask is, are these specific, maybe easier to fix issues they're highlighting? Or does it really mean the whole massive Social Security system has been fundamentally overhauled?
Right. It's easy to pick favorable data points.
Exactly. It's a common communications tactic. Highlight where you have good numbers, create a narrative of overall success, even if deeper problems might still be there. It's about managing the message, and those specific metrics help build that narrative.
And there was another angle in that communication too, wasn't there? Something about immigration.
Yes, very deliberately. They wove Social Security's integrity right into the administration's border control agenda.
How did they phrase that?
The proclamation talked about committing to, quote, restoring strong border security policies to ensure that Medicare and Social Security are preserved for the citizens who paid into them, not abused by illegal aliens who have no right to be here, end quote.
Wow, that's pretty direct language.
Incredibly direct. And it's a powerful rhetorical move. It perfectly illustrates one of the key themes we're seeing, taking complex issues and reframing them to fit campaign promises.
So taking Social Security's solvency,
which is mostly about economics, demographics, you know, longer lifespans.
Right.
And turning it into an issue of national identity, national security. Mm-hmm. Pitting citizens who paid in against illegal aliens. It reinforces that narrative of external threats jeopardizing domestic programs.
Which resonates with their base.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it connects directly to the kind of enforcement-heavy reports we'll talk about later from DHS. Yeah. It's a strategic way to build support for tougher border policies by linking them to protecting cherished programs like Social Security.
Okay, so that was the Social Security anniversary. But the White House put out another message that day too, right? About World War II.
Yes, marking the 80th anniversary of the Allied victory. And again, like the Social Security proclamation, this wasn't just about looking back.
It had a present-day purpose.
Definitely. It functioned as a platform to justify the administration's current foreign policy ideas. It started with a tribute to the greatest generation, their courage, sacrifice, fighting totalitarianism, standard respectful remembrance.
But then it pivoted.
It did. It drew this very direct line from that past struggle to today's world. It specifically mentioned Japan's transformation from a ruthless enemy to now our strongest ally in the Pacific.
Highlighting the U.S. troop presence there.
Exactly. Noting the 50,000 American troops in Japan who, quote, stand guard against new totalitarian regimes and their expansive ambitions.
So drawing a parallel between the Axis powers and current adversaries.
Precisely. It creates this powerful historical analogy. It suggests that what the administration is doing now is just a continuation of that necessary righteous fight from World War II. It gives current policy a kind of moral weight, a historical inevitability.
And did they spell out that current policy doctrine in the message?
They did, right at the end. It declared a commitment to, quote, upholding a foreign policy of peace through strength to ensure that our citizens are always put first, our sovereignty is always defended, and our nation remains the greatest country on earth.
Peace through strength. That's the core phrase.
That's the one. By wrapping it in the universally respected memory of World War II, they give that doctrine historical legitimacy. The argument becomes, this approach worked against fascism, so it'll work against today's threats. It helps build public support.
And you mentioned it connects to actual military policy shifts.
Yes, it acts as the ideological groundwork. We'll get into the details later, but think about the U.S. Army taking on a much bigger role in homeland defense. This message helps justify that.
By framing it as necessary to counter those expansive ambitions of new totalitarian regime.
Exactly. It builds the narrative needed to justify more defense spending, a broader military mission focused more on defending the homeland. It connects today's spending and strategy to a noble historical purpose. Makes it seem essential.
Okay, so the White House is definitely setting a strong tone with this messaging. But let's shift to Capitol Hill. Was anything actually getting done law-wise? Amidst all the usual gridlock?
Well, surprisingly, yes. August 14th actually gave us a glimpse of bipartisanship. It started with the president signing a bill into law.
Which one?
The Aviator Cancer Examination Study Act, the ACS Act. And this thing flew through Congress, passed 376-5 in the House, and got unanimous support in the Senate.
Wow, unanimous. You don't see that often. What does the ACS Act do?
It basically tells the VA secretary, you need to do a big comprehensive study on cancer rates among military pilots and air crews. Navy, Air Force, Marines, all of them.
Looking for links between their service and cancer?
Yeah, investigating potential connections between flying, being exposed to stuff like jet fuel, radar emissions, other toxic substances, and these higher cancer risks that seem to be showing up in aviators. It's tackling a specific health worry for that group of veterans.
And veterans groups were supportive.
Very supportive. They see it as a crucial first step towards, you know, getting better health care for these folks, more targeted cancer screenings, maybe preventative measures down the line.
Right.
For the vets and their families, it's a sign someone's listening to their health concerns.
It really highlights that veteran health care is one area where both parties can still find common ground.
It absolutely does. It stands out, doesn't it? Compared to all the fighting over other issues, it shows that these initiatives, often pushed by veterans themselves and strong advocacy groups, can cut through the partisan noise.
And politically, it's a win for everyone involved.
For sure. Lawmakers on both sides get to show they're working together, delivering for a group the public holds in really high regard. It's a good example of the system actually working, finding that common cause, even when things feel so polarized.
Okay, so the ACS Act was a bipartisan success story. What else was happening legislatively? Any new bills introduced?
Yes, and we saw kind of two different tracks for legislation emerge on the same day. First, a new bill was introduced, the PURE Water Act.
Pure Our Water, what's that about?
It stands for Public Utility Remediation and Enhancement for Water Act. It's sponsored by Representative Shulton, a Democrat from Michigan, and Representative Fitzpatrick, a Republican from Pennsylvania. So, bipartisan sponsors again.
And what does it aim to do?
It's trying to get significant federal funding for local water treatment plants to help them remove PFAS, those forever chemicals.
Ah, PFAS. That's a huge issue everywhere. Nasty stuff. Hard to get rid of.
Exactly. And very expensive to filter out. So this bill wants the federal government to step in and help municipalities pay for the necessary upgrades.
Sounds important, but also sounds expensive.
That's the challenge. The PURE Water Act is the start of what will likely be a really long, tough legislative fight. It needs big federal money, billions, maybe trillions eventually, for a major environmental health problem.
And bills with big price tags usually face uphill battles.
Especially for infrastructure, and especially when Congress is focused on spending cuts. Even with bipartisan sponsors, getting the funding approved, that's going to be the hard part. It's ambitious, but it could easily get stuck.
Okay, so that's the ambitious, costly path. What was the other track you mentioned?
The other track was illustrated by the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO. They released a cost estimate for a different bill, H.R. 2600, called the Ascend Act.
Ascend.
Yeah, it basically just formally authorizes NASA's program for buying data from commercial small satellites. Pretty technical stuff.
And the CBO cost estimate?
Negligible. Less than $500,000 over 5 years. Basically, fiscally neutral.
So, no big budget impact.
Right. Which means the Ascend Act is seen as non-controversial, technical. It can likely sail through Congress without much fuss. It's the kind of under-the-radar bill that keeps government functioning.
So, putting these two side by side.
It really shows the strategic calculations, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You have the PURE Water Act tackles a huge public need, but it's expensive, faces funding fights. Then you have Ascend Technical, costs almost nothing, smooth path to becoming law.
It's a lesson in practical politics.
Absolutely. Ambitious bills often struggle. Smaller, fiscally neutral ones offer an easier way for lawmakers to get a legislative win on the board. Sometimes the path of least resistance is just, well, the path that gets taken. Speaking of the CBO, probably the most significant report out that day was their new analysis of that big law we mentioned earlier, the OBBBA. Yes, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. The CBO released its analysis on how the law actually affects different income groups, its distributional effects, and organizations like the Medicare Rights Center were quick to highlight it.
And this analysis didn't quite match the White House's messaging from the Social Security proclamation, did it?
Not at all.
Yeah.
It showed this really profound disconnect. The White House is celebrating tax cuts for seniors, right? But the independent CBO analysis, it paints a very different picture.
What did the CBO find?
Two big things. Primarily, first, it projected the OBBA will significantly worsen income inequality. Basically, make the gap between the rich and poor wider.
Okay. And the second thing?
This one's critical. It projected major losses in health insurance coverage, especially for vulnerable folks.
How?
Specifically, the CBO found the OBBA will make 100,000 people who've paid Social Security taxes for 10 years or more, newly ineligible for Medicare.
Wow. So people who thought they qualified won't anymore.
Under this analysis, yes. Yeah. And on top of that, Another 400,000 people are projected to become uninsured because the law stops some streamlined ways people used to enroll in Medicaid and Medicare savings programs, the MSPs.
So nearly 500,000 people potentially losing coverage. That directly contradicts the White House saying OBBA makes seniors more secure.
Exactly. While some seniors get a tax break on their benefits, this vulnerable group, according to the CBO, actually loses essential health coverage. It really highlights the trade-offs. It's not just about who wins, but also understanding who might lose out under these big laws.
And what about the deficit? We talked about the tax cuts versus spending cuts. What was the CBO's bottom line on the OBBA's impact on the national debt?
The CBO, along with other independent analyses, projects the OBBA will add about $3.4 trillion to the national deficit over the next decade.
$3.4 trillion? How does that break down?
It's basically the net result of federal revenues going down by about $4.5 trillion, while direct spending only goes down by about $1.4 trillion. So much bigger tax cuts than spending cuts.
That's a huge number. The reaction must have been intense.
Oh, completely partisan, as you'd expect. Democrats immediately jumped on it, calling the law devastating for our national debt, bad for working families, a giveaway to the wealthy.
And the bill's supporters?
They pushed back hard. They challenged the CBO's methods, saying the CBO uses a flawed current law baseline. They also argued the CBO doesn't properly account for all the economic growth they believe the tax cuts will generate.
This baseline argument seems key. Can you explain that a bit more? What's the difference between current law and current policy?
Right. It sounds technical, but it's fundamental to how these numbers get calculated. The CBO's standard practice is the current law baseline. It assumes laws on the books expire when they're scheduled to. So, for example, it assumes the 2017 tax cuts expire as written.
Okay, that makes sense. So what's the current policy baseline?
Supporters of the OBBA prefer this one. It assumes certain policies, like those 2017 tax cuts, are already permanent, even if the law says they expire. So they start from a different point.
And how does that change the calculation for OBBA?
Dramatically. Under current law, OBBA adds trillions to the deficit because its tax cuts are new cuts compared to expiring ones. But under current policy, since they assume the old tax cuts were permanent anyway, they can frame OBBA spending cuts as savings relative to that baseline.
So choosing your baseline basically predetermines whether the bill looks like a deficit buster or a savings measure.
Pretty much. It's not just a technical accounting dispute. It's a fundamental fight over how we define fiscal reality. It's like arguing about your household budget, but one person assumes a temporary bonus is permanent income. The starting point changes everything.
Which makes it incredibly hard for the public, for you listening, to know who or what numbers to trust.
Exactly. When the basic assumptions are being fought over, getting an objective evaluation becomes really, really difficult. It raises that big question. How do you navigate this when the experts can't even agree on the starting point?
Okay, let's pivot now to the judicial branch, the courts. The Supreme Court was also active on August 14th. What happened there?
They issued a procedural ruling in a really high-stakes tech case. It involved NetChoice, which is a trade group for companies like Google and Meta, and a Mississippi law trying to regulate how social media platforms moderate content.
NetChoice challenged the law.
Yes. And this ruling was on an emergency request from NetChoice. They wanted the Supreme Court to lift a stay, basically allowing the law to be blocked while the case goes on. The Supreme Court said no to the emergency request.
So the Mississippi law stays in effect for now?
For now, yes. But, and this is crucial, to Justice Kavanaugh wrote a separate concurring opinion.
What did he say?
He basically signaled that NetChoice is likely to succeed on the merits eventually. He wrote that the Mississippi law is likely unconstitutional based on existing First Amendment precedent.
So the court denied the emergency relief on procedural grounds, not because they think the law is okay.
Exactly. It was about the balance of harms, weighing the immediate harm of blocking the law versus letting it stand temporarily. But Kavanaugh's concurrence sent a very clear message about where the court probably stands on the substance.
That's fascinating. It's like the court managing its workload, avoiding a rush decision, but still giving guidance.
It's a prime example of judicial signaling.
Okay.
But it also plays into this wider criticism of the court's use of the shadow docket.
Shadow docket.
Yeah, that's the term for these emergency orders and rulings that often come with very little or no legal reasoning attached. Critics, like the Brennan Center for Justice, argue the court's been using these unexplained orders more and more.
To achieve what?
Often, to let administration policies, especially controversial ones on things like immigration, go into effect quickly, even when lower courts had put them on hold with injunctions.
So procedural decisions end up having huge policy impacts.
Profound impacts. An administration policy can get implemented, bypass those lower court checks, and be in place for months or years while the full lawsuit plays out. By the time there's a final ruling on the merits, the policy might have already changed things dramatically. It's hard to undo it, to, you know, unring the bell. It effectively gives the executive branch a powerful way to fast-track policies past judicial review, at least temporarily.
Okay, outside the Supreme Court, was there other significant federal litigation happening?
Yes, another interesting case popped up, highlighting that gap between winning in court and actually getting a federal agency to comply.
What was this one?
The Attorney General of Virginia filed a lawsuit against the Department of Veterans Affairs, the VA. This was in the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals.
Suing the VA over what?
Over benefits. Specifically, the lawsuit alleges the VA isn't following the Supreme Court's 2024 decision in a case called Rudisill v. McDonough.
What did that Supreme Court case decide?
It basically guaranteed that veterans who are eligible for both the Montgomery GI Bill and the post-9/11 GI Bill should get a combined total of 48 months of educational benefits.
So they get the full benefit from both programs added together up to a cap.
That was the Supreme Court's ruling. But Virginia, along with groups like the VFW, argues the VA is using a, quote, cramped reading of the ruling and the law to wrongly deny those full 48 months to many veterans who should qualify.
So the Supreme Court ruled, but the agency isn't implementing it correctly, according to the lawsuit.
That's the allegation. It just shows that winning your case isn't always the end of the story. You often need more legal action, more political pressure, to make sure a big federal agency actually does what the court ordered. The real friction point in how government works. The implementation part is just as critical as the ruling itself.
Definitely something to watch for those veterans affected. Okay, let's shift now to national security and defense. You mentioned earlier some big changes in military posture. What was announced?
This was a major strategic realignment from the Department of Defense announced on August 14th. Lieutenant General Sean Gainey, who leads the Army's Space and Missile Defense Command, laid out a significantly expanded role for the U.S. Army, specifically in homeland defense.
Expanding beyond what they traditionally did.
Yes. Traditionally, the Army's missile defense role focused mainly on countering big intercontinental ballistic missiles, ICBMs. But this new strategy broadens that focus dramatically.
To include what kind of threats?
A whole range of newer, perhaps more immediate threats, unmanned aerial systems, drones, advanced cruise missiles, even hypersonic weapons. These are things that are faster, more maneuverable, harder to detect and stop than old school ICBMs.
And this is part of that Golden Dome concept the administration talks about.
It's a core piece of it, yes. The idea of building this multi-layered, almost impenetrable missile defense shield over the continental United States.
And the Army's role is centralizing this.
Yes. Under this plan, the Army becomes the lead service, the designated command for all air and missile defense activities under U.S. Northern Command, U.S. NORTHCOM, which is responsible for North America.
Yeah.
That's a big consolidation of authority.
What does this shift signify strategically?
It's really fundamental. It marks a move away from the dominant thinking of the last couple of decades, the post-9/11 focus on expeditionary wars, fighting insurgents overseas.
Towards what?
Towards defending the U.S. homeland itself against attacks from major state powers, peer or near-peer competitors like China or Russia.
So the idea is that the U.S. mainland isn't a safe rear area anymore. It could be a front line.
That's the implication.
Yeah.
And that has massive consequences for how money gets spent, how the military is structured, which service does what. It's a generational shift in strategic thinking, acknowledging that advanced weapons can now reach the U.S. directly.
And we saw evidence of this shift in actual spending that day, in contracts.
Absolutely. The DOD announced a bunch of contracts on August 14th. They give you a real sense of where the money is starting to flow to support this new mission.
Like what? Can you give some examples?
Sure. Let's see. eSimplicity, Inc. got nearly $100 million from the Navy for spectrum management, crucial for coordinating all these sensors and systems. Noble Supply and Logistics got $90 million from the Defense Logistics Agency for maintaining facilities. Vigor Marine got over $46 million from the Navy for ship maintenance on the USS Savannah. Banaka, Inc. got almost $20 million from the Army for construction.
And specifically missile defense related.
Yes. Lockheed Martin got over $18 million from the Missile Defense Agency, specifically for dealing with component obsolescence in the Taiji interceptors. That's a key part of the missile shield.
So these contracts, while maybe sounding routine, are actually signaling a big change.
They really are. It's not just about the dollar amounts today, it's about the long-term direction. This shift towards homeland missile defense will create huge ripple effects through the entire defense industry.
How so?
Companies that specialize in missile defense tech, advanced sensors, command and control software, AI for detecting threats, they're likely looking at a big surge in funding for years to come. Think about it. A company good at building armored vehicles for Iraq might see budgets shrink, while a startup with a new drone defense system could become huge.
It reshapes the whole defense economy.
Totally. It signals a major long-term reorientation of investment priorities. Winners and losers are being created right now based on this strategic pivot.
Okay, sticking with national security, let's turn to the Department of Homeland Security, DHS. They put out a report too.
They did. Undersecretary Kristi Noem, DHS released a big report detailing what they called their accomplishments in the first 200 days of the administration.
And what was the main narrative?
The narrative was one of, frankly, unprecedented success in securing the border and enforcing immigration laws. It was filled with really dramatic numbers.
Such as?
A claimed 93% plunge in daily encounters at the southwest border. A reported historic low of only 6,177 nationwide apprehensions in the entire month of July. And they also reported zero parole releases for May, June, and July.
93% drop. That's huge. But you said claimed and reported.
Yes, because these are self-reported statistics from DHS. They were presented without much independent verification or detail on how they were calculated. The clear goal was to create this impression of total control, overwhelming effectiveness. It shapes the public debate on the administration's terms.
It fits that theme of aggressive execution of campaign promises.
Perfectly. And the report also detailed a new program, an incentivized self-deportation program.
Incentivized? How did that work?
Well, first, they got rid of the CBP One app, which migrants had used to schedule appointments. They replaced it with the new CBP Home app. And this new app includes a feature for people to report their own deportation.
Report their own deportation.
Yeah. And DHS claimed in the report that 1.6 million illegal immigrants have left the United States population. And they're offering a $1,000 stipend, basically, cash, to people who use this app to coordinate their departure.
Wow. Using a financial incentive for self-deportation. That's novel.
Definitely a new approach.
Mm.
But the administration's strategy isn't just about this app or the border wall. The report emphasized a much broader whole-of-government attack on immigration.
What else did that include?
Things like aggressively expanding the 287G program. That's where they deputize state and local police to act as federal immigration agents. Also, ending temporary protected status, TPS, for people from several countries, putting many long-term residents at risk of deportation. Ending those humanitarian parole programs for Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, Venezuelans, closing off that legal pathway, and even starting the process to potentially decertify Harvard University from enrolling foreign students.
Harvard, wow. So they're really going after immigration from multiple angles, enforcement, legal status, even academia.
Exactly. It's a multi-front strategy. The goal seems to be to apply pressure everywhere in the immigration system, make it harder to come, harder to stay, less welcoming for non-citizens already here.
Mm.
The breadth of it is really striking. It's not just tinkering. It's trying to fundamentally restructure immigration policy across the entire government.
And one more national security item, the Department of Justice, DOJ, was involved too.
Yes. The DOJ announced criminal charges against five senior leaders of the United Cartels.
The drug cartels.
Yes. But significantly, the administration has officially designated the United Cartels as a foreign terrorist organization, an FTO.
Ah, that FTO designation again. What does that mean in this context?
Well, first, the charges were part of a coordinated push. The State Department offered up to $26 million in rewards for information leading to their capture. The Treasury Department hit them with economic sanctions, freezing assets, blocking transactions. DOJ framed it all under this banner of Operation Take Back America.
But the FTO designation itself, what does that change? We touched on this with defense strategy. How does it apply here?
It fundamentally changes the game. By calling them terrorists, not just criminals, it deliberately blurs the line between law enforcement and national security.
Giving the government more power.
Exactly. The FTO designation unlocks a whole range of tools and authorities from the military, from intelligence agencies that you normally wouldn't use against a standard criminal gang, things like enhanced surveillance, intelligence gathering, potentially even direct military-style action.
So it treats them less like criminals needing prosecution and more like enemy combatants.
That's the implication. It's a major shift in how the U.S. engages with these powerful transnational groups, with potentially significant consequences for rules of engagement and international relations, especially with Mexico. It vastly expands the government's toolkit against them.
Okay, let's bring it closer to home now and look at domestic agencies and regulations. These often have the most direct impact on everyday life for you, our listeners. Where should we start?
Let's start with economic and financial regulation. One practical change. The Treasury Department announced they're phasing out paper checks for most government payments.
Like Social Security checks, tax refunds.
Exactly. The deadline is September 30th, 2025. They want everyone to switch to direct deposit or use a Treasury-sponsored debit card.
Why the chains?
The stated reasons are pretty straightforward: reduce fraud, stolen checks, cut administrative costs, printing, mailing, and speed up payments. Get the money to people faster.
Makes sense from an efficiency standpoint, but any downsides?
Potentially, yeah.
Yeah.
Especially for people who don't have bank accounts, the unbanked, or maybe folks without reliable internet access, often older people or those in very rural areas. For them, getting benefits electronically might be a challenge. It raises questions about financial inclusion, making sure everyone can still easily access their money. It needs careful handling.
Right. What else in the financial world?
The SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, announced a big enforcement action. They charged the founder of a company making water machines and also a portfolio manager.
What was the charge?
A massive Ponzi-like scheme. We're talking $275 million defrauding over 250 investors.
Oof, that's a lot of money, a lot of victims.
It really is. It just underscores that the SEC is still actively hunting down fraud, trying to protect investors. Even with all the regulations, schemes like this still happen, unfortunately. It's a reminder of the need for vigilance.
Yeah. Any other economic indicators or reports that day?
Yes, a subtle but potentially quite revealing one from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. They put out their regular quarterly report on foreign exchange markets.
Did the U.S. intervene in the currency markets?
No, the report explicitly said there was no direct U.S. intervention to manage the dollar's value. But, and here's the interesting part, it provided some independent analysis.
What did it find?
It noted the U.S. dollar had actually depreciated lost value by 7.5% so far that year.
7.5%. That's quite a drop. Did the Fed say why?
They attributed it partly to, quote, downward revisions to the U.S. growth outlook relative to the rest of the world following the announcement of reciprocal tariffs on U.S. trading partners.
So they're linking the administration's tariffs to slower expected U.S. growth, which in turn is weakening the dollar.
That's the connection the Fed report made. When a country puts on tariffs, others often retaliate with their own tariffs. This could slow down trade, raise costs, hurt economic growth. If the U.S. outlook dims compared to other countries, investors might sell dollars, pushing its value down.
It shows the unintended consequences, the ripple effects of trade policy.
Exactly. It's an independent assessment suggesting those trade policies might be having complex, maybe even negative impacts on the U.S. currency strength, something often lost in the political back and forth.
And one more economic item. The DOJ's antitrust division did something.
Yes, they set up a brand new whistleblower rewards program. They partnered with the U.S. Postal Service on this.
Offering rewards for what?
For people reporting illegal anti-competitive stuff, price fixing between companies, rigging bids on contracts, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
If your tip leads to successful enforcement, you could get a financial reward.
And the timing was interesting, you said.
Very interesting. This came just one day after the administration had revoked a much broader executive order that was aimed at promoting competition across the economy.
So they repeal a broad order, then launch this specific whistleblower program. What does that suggest?
It really suggests a shift in their strategy for antitrust, for promoting competition, maybe moving away from broad top-down regulations, which some see as burdensome.
Towards more targeted enforcement.
Yeah, possibly a carrot-and-stick approach. The carrot is less broad regulation overall. The stick is aggressive. Targeted enforcement against specific companies caught breaking the rules, using whistleblowers to help find them. It's a different philosophy relying more on catching bad actors than setting rules for everyone. It puts more onus on individuals to report wrongdoing.
Okay, let's switch to health and environmental policy. A big move at HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services.
A very big and potentially very controversial move. HHS, which is now led by Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., announced they are reviving the Task Force on safer childhood vaccines.
A task force on vaccine safety, what's its stated goal?
The stated purpose is to promote the development of vaccines that cause, quote, fewer and less serious adverse reactions.
And this wasn't entirely out of the blue.
No. It actually came after a lawsuit was filed against HHS by the Children's Health Defense. That's the anti-vaccine advocacy group that Secretary Kennedy himself founded before joining the administration. Their lawsuit aimed to force HHS to bring this task force back.
So the head of HHS is reviving a task force pushed by his own former organization, which is known for vaccine skepticism.
Precisely. And this is a really significant moment for public health policy in the U.S. It takes a viewpoint that is deeply skeptical of the established scientific consensus on vaccine safety, a viewpoint usually on the fringes, and puts it right at the heart of the federal government's health apparatus.
What's been the reaction from the medical community?
Immediate alarm. Groups like the American Medical Association voice serious concerns, fearing this task force will undermine public trust in vaccines, which are proven lifesavers, and basically politicize what should be scientific issues.
What are the potential long-term impacts here?
If this perspective gets institutionalized within HHS, it could be profound. It could erode public confidence in vaccination programs, potentially leading to lower vaccination rates and the resurgence of diseases we thought were under control. It represents a major shift in how science informs public health policy, embedding a very controversial ideology within the government itself.
Wow. Okay. What about the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency? Anything major there?
Well, they published some routine notices about approving state air quality plans, standard stuff, but there was something more significant tucked away.
What was that?
They announced they'll be holding a public hearing soon about an interim final rule. And this rule extends the deadlines for oil and gas companies to comply with regulations for controlling methane emissions.
Methane is a potent greenhouse gas, so they're giving companies more time to comply.
Yes. And this is a classic example of something called deregulation by delay.
How does that work?
Instead of going through a big, politically messy, legally complex fight to formally repeal the methane rule, the EPA just pushes back the compliance deadlines. It achieves a similar policy outcome, easing the burden on the oil and gas industry, but does it quietly procedurally.
So the rule stays on the books, but its impact is weakened because companies don't have to act as quickly.
Exactly. It allows them to keep operating as they were for longer. It's a subtle but effective way to roll back regulation without attracting as much attention as a full repeal, an administrative tactic to achieve a policy goal.
Interesting. Okay, let's look at intellectual property and commerce. Something happened at the Patent and Trademark Office, the USPTO.
Yes, they issued a final rule, and it took effect immediately, eliminating their special expedited examination program for design patents. This program is often called the Rocket Docket.
The Rocket Docket. For getting design patents approved faster, why eliminate it?
According to the USPTO, the program was being overwhelmed by a massive flood of fraudulent applications.
Fraudulent how?
Specifically, applicants were falsely claiming micro-entity status. That's a category for very small inventors or businesses that lets them pay much lower fees. But tons of ineligible applicants were apparently claiming it, clogging up the system.
So the fraud was slowing things down for everyone.
Exactly. It was actually increasing the time it took to get legitimate patents approved because the examiners were swamped with junk applications. So the USPTO made a policy choice.
Which was?
To prioritize the overall integrity and efficiency of the entire patent system over providing this super fast track for a few. They decided the fraud was so bad, it was better to just shut down the expedited pathway altogether rather than try to police every single application claiming micro-entity status.
It raises questions about how vulnerable these systems are to widespread fraud, doesn't it?
It really does, especially online systems. When the abuse reaches a scale where the only solution seems to be eliminating the service, it highlights a real challenge in balancing accessibility and convenience with security and integrity.
Finally, let's touch on foreign affairs again, specifically international agreements. You mentioned something earlier linking back to immigration.
Yes, a significant diplomatic move. Secretary of State Marco Rubio signed a memorandum of understanding with Paraguay's foreign minister, Ruben Ramirez Lizcano.
An MOU about what?
It establishes what's called a Safe Third Country Agreement, or STCA, between the U.S. and Paraguay.
Safe Third Country. What does that mean in practice?
It creates a legal mechanism. Under this agreement, certain asylum seekers who arrive in the United States can potentially be transferred to Paraguay to have their asylum claims processed there, not in the U.S.
So the U.S. sends asylum seekers to Paraguay for processing. Why?
The stated purpose, according to the announcement, is to, quote, share the burden of managing illegal immigration while shutting down the abuse of our nation's asylum system.
And the link to domestic immigration policy was clear.
Very clear. The Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security was right there at the signing ceremony. It directly connects to the administration's broader goal of reducing the number of asylum seekers processed within the U.S. It fits that whole-of-government approach we discussed.
Is this kind of agreement common?
It's becoming more common. It's a key part of a wider strategy we're seeing among many developed countries, trying to externalize their border control and asylum processing, basically pushing the responsibility onto other countries.
What's the impact on the asylum seekers themselves?
Well, from the U.S. perspective, it reduces the number of people needing processing and support within the country without formally rejecting their right to seek asylum under international law, at least not initially.
But there must be criticism.
Oh, sharp criticism. Human rights groups argue these agreements can put vulnerable people at risk. They question whether the third country, in this case, Paraguay, really has the resources, the legal framework, the protections needed to handle these asylum claims fairly and safely.
So connecting this to the bigger picture,
it really changes the whole landscape of international responsibility for refugees and asylum seekers. If more countries adopt these STCAs, it could fundamentally shift global norms, potentially making it much harder for people fleeing persecution to find safety. It externalizes the problem rather than addressing the root causes or sharing the burden equitably.
Okay, we've covered a huge amount of ground from just one day, August 14th. If we try to synthesize all of this, pull it together, what are the main themes or takeaways?
I think three dominant themes really stand out from that day's activities. They paint a pretty coherent picture of this administration's governing style.
Okay, what's the first one?
First, just the aggressive, determined execution of campaign promises. You see it everywhere. The OBBBA tax cuts for seniors, the hardline immigration enforcement from DHS, that safe third country deal with Paraguay, the peace through strength foreign policy rhetoric.
It's a direct translation of what they said they'd do into action.
Exactly. A real focus on delivering for their political base,
yeah,
fulfilling those promises quickly and decisively.
Okay. Theme number one, executing promises. What's the second?
Second is this pattern of systemic restructuring of the state itself. This goes deeper than just changing policies.
How so? Give me examples.
Think about the Army's big pivot to homeland defense. That's not just a budget tweak. It's a generational strategic change. Or look at HHS institutionalizing vaccine skepticism with that task force that aims to alter the very foundation of public health science in the government. Or the DOJ's different approach to antitrust.
These aren't just minor adjustments.
Not at all. They feel like fundamental shifts, attempt to reshape the core mission, the ideology, the long-term direction of these key government bodies.
Mm-hmm.
The scope of these changes is really quite fascinating, and the consequences will likely last for a very long time.
Okay. Aggressive execution, systemic restructuring. What's the third theme?
The third is that recurring, widening gap between the administration's narrative, their claims of success, and the analysis coming from independent, nonpartisan sources.
We saw that clearly with the OBBBA, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The White House celebrating benefits for seniors, while the CBO is detailing how other vulnerable seniors lose health coverage under the same law. Or the administration pushing trade policies, while the Federal Reserve links those same policies to a weaker dollar.
And the vaccine task force example, too?
Right. Framed as pursuing rigorous science, while the established medical community condemns it as dangerous and anti-science.
What does this conflict point towards?
It points towards a future where disagreements aren't just about policy choices, but about basic facts, about evidence, about who qualifies as an expert, about objective reality itself. It makes public policy debates incredibly difficult.
And it raises that crucial question for you, the listener. How do you navigate this? How do you figure out what's actually going on when the official story and the independent data seem to be telling two different stories?
It puts a huge burden on citizens to be critical consumers of information, to seek out multiple sources, to understand the assumptions behind the numbers. It's a real challenge for informed democracy.
So, summing up August 14th, 2025, it was a day showcasing an administration moving very fast, very decisively, to implement its agenda.
Definitely achieving many of its short-term goals with real determination. No question about that. But potentially at a significant long-term cost. Cost to fiscal stability, maybe to scientific integrity, maybe to establish international norms and alliances. The actions taken on just this one day have really set the stage for some major political, legal, and social battles ahead. battles that will shape where the country goes for years.
Which leads us to that final thought for you to consider.
Yeah. Given this clear pattern we've seen today, an administration acting decisively, often pushing narratives that conflict with independent analysis, what new challenges does this pose? Challenges for transparency in government, for objective fact-finding? And maybe more importantly, how will these dynamics affect your ability, personally, to stay truly informed and make sense of it all in the months and years ahead?
That is definitely something to think about. We really hope this deep dive has helped you connect the dots, giving you a clearer, more comprehensive picture of the flurry of federal activity just from that single day, August 14th.
Understanding how these seemingly separate actions fit together is key.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us on the deep dive. We appreciate your time, your curiosity, and your commitment to digging deeper.